Hello, and welcome to IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast, brought to you by Learning Essentials. Learning Essentials offers special education-based tutoring in your home by state-certified educators with advanced degrees in all areas of special education. IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast brings professionals together to educate and empower families navigating special education needs in the IEP process.
Welcome to the IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. Today we are talking about school reentry, trauma, anxiety, and support. Joining us is Dr. Kelly Fraden. Dr. Kelly Fraden is a pediatrician, a mother of two, and a child advocate based in New York City. Originally from Charlotte, North Carolina, she was inspired to become a doctor by her experience surviving childhood cancer. At Harvard College, she received an honors degree in psychology for her thesis on physiologic response to stress across variable socioeconomic backgrounds. She graduated from Columbia College of Physicians and Surgeons in New York City and completed her pediatric residency at the Children's Hospital in the Bronx. Subsequently, she joined the faculty where she cared for children with complex medical conditions, inpatient and outpatient, conducted clinical research, and educated medical students and residents. As she balanced motherhood with medicine, she stepped back from the role to work in a public health capacity with NYC schools in the South Bronx and began sharing parenting and health information on social media. Welcome. I am so excited to talk to you at such a time in where we are in our world with school and reentry to have your insight and guidance. So thank you so much for joining us.
Yes. Thank you for putting together all the resources you do. I know families must appreciate it.
Thank you so much. So here where I'm recording, just outside of DC, a lot of schools started to go back this week in kind of that hybrid fashion. I know throughout the country, different schools are in different phases of their reentry to school. So how can we start prepping our kids for reentry into school and back into the world after this year of COVID?
So I think it's a great question, and it's something that parents should have on their to-do list. I think it's hard for parents when the news seems to be constantly changing and there's so much to process, but we need to keep our children informed so that they can understand the context of all the changes happening to them. This, you know, having a story or a narrative about why it's okay to make these different changes will help your children to feel confident in them. And so to do that, you have to really think about where your child is developmentally and what they can understand and what media sources is your child exposed to, because they may be hearing things from places that aren't necessarily as reputable, like their friends. I wrote an article for Parents Magazine about how to do like a coronavirus check-in, and I recommended kind of like a sandwich approach. And this is like, there's the check-in sandwich or the feedback sandwich that has been sort of debunked as a method of giving feedback to your employees. But for this purpose, I think it's helpful for parents. So you start the conversation by being like, you know, it's been a really tough time dealing with all the pandemic changes, but I've noticed something about your child that's specific that's been helpful. I've noticed that you've become more independent in some of your routines. I noticed that you've managed to maintain some of your friendships by being social, or that you've been finding creative outlets by your art or whatever it is, something that has been intrinsic to your child's personality that has helped them with this time. And just shine light on that. And then you can dive in to some of the more serious things you want to discuss. You know, the rates are down, the teachers are getting vaccinated, the public health authorities say school is safe now, and I'm excited for this change and to brand it in a positive light. And then it's okay to have to kind of fish a little. How do you feel about it? Is there anything you're worried about? Or I think it's normal to have some worries. I wonder if your friends are feeling nervous, because sometimes talking about friends is less of a commitment for children than talking about themselves, but it may teach you a lot about where they are. And then, you know, you have your conversation or your multiple conversations, because sometimes you you don't catch the right moment for your child to talk, which is normal. And then you close it by making sure they know that they're safe and they're supported, right? So you say, as we make this change and cope with this, it's important for you to remember that we're here for you. Your mom, your dad, your grandparents, your babysitter, we're all on your team. So if you ever want to talk about this, let me know. And that just like is an investment in your future connection.
It's a great way to lead it for sure. And to really kind of start. And you're right, it can take those multiple conversations. What are some things that we can start to talk about in terms of what will school look like, right? You know, in terms of the desk and the mask and, you know, what are some suggestions that they should bring back in terms of PPE or materials or any of those things?
So I do think it's helpful for children to have masks available to change. You know, logistically, children do get their masks wet or soiled, or they get food on them after meals. And having a clean, dry mask is going to help them feel more comfortable and help the mask work more appropriately. So, you know, I would make sure there's a backup mask available at school. And if your child is, you know, sometimes when you pick them up, if you're then going to commute with them and they need to continue masking to have a fresh mask after school, I think that that can be really helpful. In terms of preparing children, I think it's even when we obsess about the school plans and we read them in great detail, sometimes as parents outside the school, we don't know exactly what's going to happen. So I would try to leave room for the possibility that you'll just have to see how it goes, and that it's new for everybody. And what that means for your child's experience in the school, it is uncertain. So, you know, you can go through everything that you expect to be the case, but then just leave that door ajar in terms of there may be some surprises, but we'll figure it out together. Because I think that that sets the stage for the truth that everybody is kind of adjusting together.
Kind of ease those for our anxious friends that are going back and they hear, well, there may be some surprises, and they think, I can't do this. And they want to just crawl back inside. So what are some phrases, some suggestions that we could provide for our anxious kiddos that are not ready for any type of surprise and transitions are super hard?
Yes. So I think one important thing to do is normalize what they're feeling. I think as we talk to children about anxiety can feel really scary when it happens to you. You know, your heart may race, you may feel like you're breathing quickly or you're sweaty. And because of those somatic feelings, you know, that may be scary for children. So to reinforce that those feelings they're not dangerous, that you're still safe. Everybody has feelings like that, and that's how our body gears up for something new or a challenge. What we control is our response to those feelings. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by feeling anxious, you know, there are things you can do, whether it's taking some deep breaths, asking for help, you know, taking a moment to rest, or distracting yourself with play or schoolwork. You know, there's other options too, like kind of positive self-talk, like I'm not going to let my worry monster get me down, or some kind of other statements that children can focus on. But I think it goes a long way to just let them know that they're not alone in those anxious feelings, and that a lot of adults are struggling with like a fear of normal too. We've gotten so used to being more isolated that this change is difficult.
I think also kind of to follow up on that with the anxiety and prepping them, you know, kind of when they return to ask, how did you feel like once you pushed through that anxiety? I know I've talked to some kids about that as well, just, you know, in the education realm, that once they've done something, and we've talked about the feelings and all the workup beforehand, but then kind of closing that door on that and asking, how did you feel? And so they can process that, yes, I had all these feelings, but I did it. I pushed through it. And look, I came out and things are okay. And I feel comfortable, you know, and I have used the term before called slay the dragon with kiddos, and to say, you know, go slay the dragon. You've got this, you're the knight. And then when they come back with their experience, you know, how did it go? Did you slay the dragon? And just kind of to put it more in a kid's term as well. So are there some questions that parents should be asking the school, the teacher, you know, before sending their kids back to school?
So I think it's always important to have a plan for what happens if something goes wrong. So, you know, I think it's important that parents know if there's an exposure in the class, what's going to happen, how does the reporting work, and what will be the process to return to the classroom, how will we decide it's safe. So I think most schools have done a really excellent job at being proactive and disclosing their plans. But I do think that parents need to understand them, especially as we open back up more. And parents should understand what the school's expectations are for their out-of-school behavior, because these communities to stay safe do require that all the families participating continue to take precautions. So, for example, you know, we're getting ready to have spring break here in New York. And you know, the schools have been very clear that if you travel, you need to be very careful and quarantine and test before returning to school. And so to have that expectation in mind, we can make plans to keep the school community safe.
So what are some behaviors that parents can expect upon their children's return to school?
So I would compare this to the return to school that we see every fall, you know, and I think that the most common things we see from children is that they get very tired. Especially the younger children, sometimes you need to move bedtime earlier because it's exhausting to be in such a stimulating environment when you've been home. And dealing with some of these anxious feelings and new routines is a lot. So there's the fatigue. There's, of course, sometimes the separation anxiety, in addition to the anxiety about masking and returning to a school that looks different. We have the fact that a lot of kids have been with their parents more than ever. And that process may be, you know, it may affect children who have never had it in the past because they've never had nearly a year of being with their parents full time to get used to that rhythm. So I would expect it to last at least 6 to 8 weeks, some of these changes, because it just takes time to get into a new routine.
And I like that you said, because we've been inside, you know, just not out in the world as much as we have been in terms of the stimulating part. And I would imagine just even a fatigue of movement, which kind of sounds silly, Dr. Freedom, but I would think that because our kids that have been all online and now back into school, you know, they're used to sitting, which they do at school, but there's movement breaks and stuff like that throughout the day. So I would think that just kind of getting comfortable with being back to moving and interacting and being social again. Do you have any suggestions for that, just kind of easing that social component and engaging in friendships and stuff like that?
Yes. You know, I have found that to be one of the biggest challenges because though my kids have both been back in school, it's not the same. And so you have to understand what your specific school is doing. Like my son, for example, he's at his desk all day. And his recess, he has his own box of toys. So he's not having a lot of those social experiences with other children in the school environment. They even like discourage them from talking at lunchtime by putting on documentaries and stuff. So I have been trying to fill those social needs outside of school, you know, in a safe way as possible, like having a lot of outdoor play dates with his friends from his class. So I think that even though you're back in school, sometimes it's a longer process for addressing some of these needs that I think will continue well into, you know, 2022, unfortunately.
That's a great segue to my next question then. So what are some potential red flags to look for with a returning student who may be struggling with trauma or anxiety related to COVID or just their experience during this year?
Yes. So as a pediatrician, when, you know, it's my pediatric colleagues said the flu didn't really happen this winter, right? Which is normally like our offices are full of RSV and flu, but the clinics have been just as busy because of all the mental health concerns from the children, because parents are trying to navigate you know, this anxiety, is it normal? What do I do? Who do I see? A lot of kids are feeling anxious. And I think that when you're grappling with that as a parent, I think some of the first things you can do is make sure that your children have enough opportunities to move their bodies. Exercise, physical activity has been shown to improve feelings of like anxiety and depression by 40%, which is really astounding. It can really help promote focus in school and positive behaviors. The other big thing we can do is think about sleep. So a lot of families are having trouble getting adequate sleep, especially if they're less active. The kids may not be as tired. Maybe we've gotten into habits where we have more lax routines for bedtime. But children who don't get enough sleep will feel more anxious. So I think the first, if you're worried that your child is kind of bordering on the sign of having excessive anxiety, to prioritize the physical activity and the sleep, and then to look at how those feelings are impacting their life. It's about function. Are the feelings that they're having interrupting their ability to get through the school day, to do their academic work, to have positive relationships with their family and their peers? And then by understanding how those feelings are affecting those things, you understand how much help you need in dealing with it. Because if it is really impacting those very important things, it's time to get help.
So what are some questions that parents could ask to gauge their kiddo's mental state without sounding like they are prodding or hovering or just being intrusive?
So, you know, I think it's going to vary by age. I do think with the younger children, some children are very insightful and have good emotional intelligence, but sometimes they don't. And with elementary age children, often a parent's observations may be more helpful than their questioning. I don't think all children are really able to say like, oh, I'm feeling nervous about this. They may show you that they're nervous by withdrawing or avoiding activities or, resisting things that they should enjoy. You can talk with older children about it. And I think it's helpful to do that side by side rather than face to face. It sounds like a small change, but when you're, in the car together or going for a walk together, sometimes you can do it in a less confrontational way to be like, with all these changes, like I'm feeling a little nervous about seeing more people than I really got used to being more isolated. How are you feeling about it? And I think you can set an example for talking about things that are hard for you without kind of collapsing under the weight of it, that sometimes it may feel big for a child to admit that they have a negative feeling. And so if we can model that we have negative feelings too, but we keep going and we don't feel ashamed of them or hide them or feel overwhelmed by them, hopefully we can open those dialogues with our children.
Can you explain, we're trying to talk about anxiety, but what is the difference between like nervousness and stress than actual anxiety?
That's a good question. So I think it becomes anxiety when it starts to be excessive. So sometimes a child who's nervous, you can say that they are nervous about going back to school and they have trouble sleeping the night before going back to school because there is a trigger for that feeling. And when you have like true anxiety, sometimes the triggers become less clear. You might feel like, you can't pick out what to wear because you're overwhelmed by all the options, or you can't focus on reading your book because your brain is just thinking about all the different things that are going on in your life. And so those feelings are, one, they're starting to interfere with your functioning, and two, they're occurring sometimes at inappropriate triggers. So sometimes the worries will start to take over in that way, which is why it's so important that as we deal with children who are feeling more anxious, that we don't develop a habit of avoidance. That a common reaction for parents is like, oh, this is an unpleasant feeling for you. Like, let's avoid it as much as possible. But sometimes that can actually worsen anxiety because it sends the message of, you're right, that's a dangerous feeling, that's bad, let's change things to avoid it. And you can get into a cycle of limiting and limiting and limiting, and then having less of those moments where you slay the dragon, as you were saying it, where you your success can build. So if you have a child who's really nervous about going out, for example, you may maybe can take some smaller outings, like going to the library or going to a grocery store with your child. And then afterwards you could be like, yeah, I felt a little nervous and uncomfortable being around those people, but I was okay. And those smaller exposures can kind of build momentum for tackling some of the bigger things.
Yeah, that's excellent. Excellent advice. As a parent, what is the best first step to take if I realize my child is struggling to acclimate to the new normal?
Okay, so I think the first things that I mentioned are to focus on, you know, the basics of wellness, to make sure your child knows that they're safe, to make sure they're getting enough physical activity and sleep, to make sure that they're connected to someone, that maybe sometimes when children are struggling, they disconnect from their parents. And sometimes it's less about you and more about what they're able to grasp. So if your child won't talk to you about what's wrong, try not to take it personally, but in those settings, I would ask for help sooner. And whether you start with the school, if the school has a counseling team, or whether you start with your pediatrician, sometimes having a third party get involved can open the door of communication and help you understand like where they are and what they need at that time. So I would, especially in the climate that we live in, where sometimes it takes 2 or 3 months to really get connected to mental health services, I would err on the side of getting help earlier, because sometimes it's hard to tell if it will settle out and your child will, adapt to meet these demands and get used to their new normal, or if maybe they won't. And so if you're worried about it, to kind of make the appointments and get the referrals, and then you can always cancel them if your child seems not to need them. But I'd rather you have the opportunity to get help sooner rather than later, because I think when children are at a, say, like a higher functioning state with their difficulties, sometimes that's actually an opportunity for a third party to really teach coping skills that a child can integrate. Sometimes, like, if you wait for it to be really bad, it's harder to make a difference. So I think that early is better.
For sure. We even say that in the education world. Early is better. And you're right. You can always make those appointments. And then if you realize things are settling down, you can go ahead and cancel them. But it's fantastic to get on the radar and get on the schedule when it can take quite some time, especially now when mental health is really busy at this point. So just to kind of get on their radar. How can parents and teachers encourage children to communicate their thoughts, feelings, worries, fears about returning to school?
So I do think that modeling it and leaving space for it is really helpful. You know, I think there are some great books that model for younger children, books like Ruby Has a Worry, or help my dragon deal with anxiety. There are some children's books that can facilitate conversations. Older children, there's a graphic novel by Raina Telegemeier. It's called Guts. Or even, you know, TV shows or movies, I'm sure there are opportunities to discuss it too. Sometimes it helps to have that perspective of like what other people are dealing with to then talk about our own feelings. So I'd encourage parents to use some of those tools to just open conversations. And again, the modeling ourselves, how we're feeling, and that we can talk about hard things without being embarrassed or fearful of it.
So we've kind of talked about parents and kind of recognizing their kiddos' needs and what that would look like in those conversations. I kind of like to, let's talk about the school a little bit. You know, teachers, and you know, they're receiving these kiddos that are, you know, and then in real time they're going to see these feelings, and we're all, as educators, are having the feelings ourselves, right? And all of us, right? No matter what our jobs are having these feelings of readjustment and reentry and stuff, and just trying to deal with our own place and emotions. So how can we as educators, we as the school, how can we set up success for our kiddos as they're returning?
Yes, that's a great question. So I'm a big fan of, even actually before the pandemic, of schools being trauma-informed or trauma-certified. And what that process entails is sort of integrating strategies into the curriculum, not just for social and emotional development, but also for coping. So things like breathing exercises or yoga movement breaks or mindfulness exercises, meditations, that some of these things you can integrate in a small way and for the whole school community. Because the kind of problem that we're facing at a society level, we don't even really understand the scope of it yet. But if we look at, there's some studies out of Korea where they had the MERS outbreak, I think it was back in 2012, and they found rates of anxiety, clinically significant anxiety in the communities of like 40% following that. So normally for children, you know, it's under 8%, like maybe around 5%. So you may expect that it will double. Right. And so we're talking about a lot of children who may need help. So rather than try to address those all piecemeal, I think to provide coping strategies for everyone is a better strategy in some circumstances. And I hate to ask schools to do more when you're already doing so much. But I think that if you can integrate some of these coping strategies into your curriculum and do them regularly, it can be such a positive thing for students. I think the other thing that we can do is sort of have our expectations in line that when we are all coping, you know, the children are coping with a lot of change and it's been a difficult year, that the catching up and the academics may not move forward at the rate that they did prior to the pandemic. You know, like as an adult, I'm not at 100% productivity right now. I'm doing my best, but maybe I'm closer to 80%. So we may be dealing with the prospect of trying to help kids catch up from what they've missed and make progress. But I think we have to give ourselves and our students some grace in this and try to prioritize what's most important. And so I think some families may need support too in that process, because I'm sure parents are anxious for their kids to catch up and be academically on track. But I think we have to be patient and have faith that the kids will catch up with more time, but you may not be able to rush. So I think that while I'm asking you to do more in terms of helping our kids cope and identifying the students who seem to be struggling the most to refer them for help, I'm also asking us to like be okay with doing a little bit less academically and try to, you know, give ourselves some time.
My head is swirling. Absolutely, 100%. And hopefully the state testing and all of that can be put on pause while we have the space and to allow teachers that space to rebuild that community and thinking about providing coping skills and social emotional support. And as you said, providing that grace and that space to try to weave that back into the classroom. You know, our educators are fabulous and have always aimed to create the space for our kids to grow and nurture and love and learn and to really kind of take that to the next level, I would think, to provide these moments. So what are some resources for schools and communities that they could use, that they could really integrate? And you're right, you know, teachers are busy and there's a lot happening and they don't want something extra. But I feel like with your guidance, we can find some resources that really make it just part of their classroom community and not really have to feel like they're doing something extra.
That's a great question. I'm trying to think. There is actually like a website called Trauma Informed Schools where they do the certifications and they have a lot of resources. And I'm sure that on the website, there may be some ideas, but I don't think that it needs to be complicated. You know, I think you can, even if you say like, okay, for the developmental status of the children in my class, I think that meditation sounds good. And just saying that, you know, at this period in the day, we're always just going to take 5 minutes and we'll listen to a guided meditation that's for free on my phone, or we'll listen to some classical music and then we'll talk about how it makes us feel. You know, I think it can be as simple as that, just to show that there's value. You know, we never know exactly when you have a mixed community, a mixed classroom, you never know exactly what skills the children have learned at home and what they're bringing. And so I think even if the children have sort of a literacy for the coping skills, giving opportunity to practice it can be valuable. And even for adults, like, you know, having a space in your day to breathe, and to try to clear your mind, you know, it can be so valuable. So I don't think it has to be complicated to be effective.
What is exactly trauma-informed? We kind of have tossed this term around. What does that actually mean?
Right. That's a good question. So the idea came from the field of research around adverse childhood experiences. And those, there's nine of them that are formally recognized, which include like having a loved one with mental illness, witnessing violence in the home, dealing with the death of a loved one, these sort of big, you know, a physical or emotional abuse. I'm not remembering all of them, but there are these big stressors. The studies originally came out of Kaiser, I think, that they looked at adults and adult health. So they said, if you have, you know, three adverse childhood experiences, your rates of diabetes and asthma as an adult are higher. You're actually more likely to get cancer and all of these things, because the idea is that this toxic stress, when it's experienced early, has a really negative effect on your health. And sometimes by addressing the underlying trauma, you can have a bigger impact on someone's health than trying to piecemeal address their lifestyle choices and their hypertension and their diabetes. So that's where the ball started. And now, you know, we're much more aware of the impact of these stressors over the lifetime, and we would love to address it as young as possible. Of course, it's a can of worms to start trying to screen for children who have experienced these very private and personal kinds of stress in the school system. So there's a movement for pediatricians to try to identify these children so that they can provide appropriate specific resources for the stress that they've endured. But in the school setting, it's the idea that rather than, you know, asking children if they've been the victims of abuse, which is like, you know, maybe not appropriate in the classroom, you know, you may just assume that sometimes negative behaviors or difficulties may come from a background of having a traumatic experience. And that by teaching these coping skills universally, you can help kids overcome their stress. Even if you're not specifically addressing the trauma, you're kind of being aware that negative behaviors and difficulty learning often come as a consequence of toxic stress. So teaching coping and stress management will help those children rather than just focusing on the negative behavior in the classroom. And one of the most powerful findings with regard to children is actually one of the simplest. The AAP has they've been trying to make a hashtag happen about it, because it's the idea that children who have three sources of support are much less likely to have consequences from trauma. And so they say like their parents, their doctor, their teachers, and there's this push to like be a three, which is like just by being someone who can support the child and being on their team, you're already doing a lot for them. But sometimes being aware of the importance of that, you know, that's the idea behind trauma-informed schools, is that people have an awareness that this is a problem and an awareness that they have a valuable role in being a support to students.
What is social-emotional wellness?
That's a good question. obviously, like, I kind of, when I think about it, I think about the, like, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? So, like, we have our physical health and safety at the bottom, that we have to have that. And then the social and emotional wellness, you know, those skills, connection with other people is also really a core to like a core human need. And so social and emotional wellness, it tells me that the child has the ability to gain those things from others. And what that means may be different for different children, but being able to like express your emotions and ask for comfort when you need it and form friendships and play with others and interact with others in a positive way. Those are all like kind of core social and emotional wellness indicators for children.
You've listed some. How does that develop over the years, you know, for an elementary, middle, high school, so that as educators, as parents, as community members, we can kind of have this awareness of what that could or should look like? And potentially when, you know, kind of help to monitor to be one of those three support people of just monitoring what that could look like and how to know to reach out for additional support.
Yes. I feel like I've been biased towards talking a lot about elementary age kids because my own kids are young. So it's just kind of what I think about. So I'll jump right to talking about older kids. So I think it gets a lot more challenging in middle and high school. Because middle and high school, even before the pandemic and even without the stress, can be such a tumultuous time. And the way that our kids are connecting with each other is increasingly through screens and video games and things like that, that it's harder for us to monitor. So I think teachers and parents, what we're looking for is for children, we want to have our radar up if children are starting to withdraw. If they're not finding joy from the things that they used to find joy from, whether it's video games or sports or hobbies, those are the kids that I want to take a closer look at. And as you take a closer look at those children, you know what? One of the things that we're wondering is, are they connected with their peers? Do they have some of those really important friendships that they become so important to kids at those developmental stages? And when you're thinking about those friendships, it's like, are they positive friendships? Do they make the child feel better? Are they like, you know, people who are providing kind of unconditional support to the child? Or are they relationships that are more difficult? Or sometimes like there can be some bullying dynamics and things like that. So I want to take a closer look to the kinds of friendships the child has. But if the child seems to be like doing okay, sometimes you may not have to dig that deep. You can just trust that like they'll show signs of if they're struggling. So I'm more worried about people picking up on those kids that are withdrawing and not finding joy. And maybe sometimes parents will note that their sleep habits will change and their appetites will change. Those are the kids that we really need to dig in and say, like, what are their friendships like and where are they getting their support? And maybe they need more.
If our child isn't struggling, but they have a friend that is struggling, are there tools that we could provide them to help them understand and support their friend, their classmate?
That's a great question. I'm trying to think of a good tool for this. You know, the University of Florida, they have a website about the effects of toxic stress in children. And they have some interactive content for kids about like how trauma affects you and coping skills that might be useful. But I do think in general, it's great to encourage your child to be a support for someone else. I know that as a parent, sometimes people worry about it being catching, right? The struggling, that they worry that their kid, if this other child is depressed or anxious, that those feelings may like rub off. But I think it's actually on the contrary, that if your child is in a position to provide help to another person, they can gain self-esteem and gain sort of emotional and social literacy by being a support person. But, you know, what you want to do is just maintain that communication, that your child knows that they can talk to someone if they feel like it's too much or it's overwhelming. And sometimes that includes monitoring like computers and electronic communications, just as our responsibility for our kids to keep them safe. Like if things are getting to like a very dark place for their friends, somebody needs to know. And the child shouldn't be in a position where they don't, you know, friendships have privacy in them, but children are children and still need help with some of these bigger things. So we want to make sure that we walk that line of like giving them space, but also keeping them safe.
So you talked about monitoring those communications and just even monitoring online activity for kiddos with technology. Do you have like a thought on age? Do you have a thought on should there be transparency about the fact that parents are monitoring? You know, what does your pediatrician hat tell us?
I'm a big fan of like technology contracts. And there's this group called We Start Now that has a lot of free resources on this for parents about when your child gets a phone or a tablet, that you just lay out what the expectations are from the beginning. The parent needs to have knowledge of what they're doing. And for maybe the first few years, the child probably should use that not alone in their bedroom, that there should be some kind of backup supervision. And I know it's difficult, especially when we're all working from home and balancing multiple roles. There are some services that can help, like Bark and Circle. There are these subscription services where they'll try to like monitor your child's device for you. But there's a never-ending amount of like ways around it. Kids communicating through Google Docs that they're using for school, and then they can delete, and kids communicating through the chat functions within Roblox and all of these things. So I just find for most parents, it becomes quickly pretty overwhelming. So that's when it becomes helpful to join your child in what they're doing, to, you know, sometimes go into their room and sit next to them and be like, show me what you're working on. Like, and if you do it regularly, your child may be less resistant. It can be harder to change tactics, but it's possible to change tactics. So if you haven't been supervising and you want to start, you might, you know, have like a little meeting with your family and be like, you know, I'm worried about this. I've heard some children are accessing things that may be inappropriate, or like meeting some people who actually aren't what they're pretending to be online. And I'd like to make sure that you're safe, and you know, I want to do it in a way that's respectful for you. So like, let's talk about it so we can develop a plan together. So I would encourage parents to have a plan.
I love that idea of just having a family conversation about it and kind of sharing your thoughts and then hearing what the kiddos have to say, so that there can be more of that dialogue and that respect between all family involved with that. So what kind of, back to the school and the transition and COVID, what programs could schools adopt to help ease that transition to in-person learning?
So what programs could they adopt? Let's see.
Or just kind of what's a nugget of wisdom, I guess, if we even wanted to take it down, maybe not the whole school, but just if you, as a, you know, coming in, if you could just sprinkle a nugget of wisdom for a teacher within their classroom, and then also for an administrator that is helping to kind of govern the school.
I think it's helpful for all of us to think about, in normal times, that back to school phase. And having worked in the schools for several years, I'm aware of the truth that the first 6 weeks of most school years are really spent adapting to the new rhythms of the classroom. And this year, when maybe we're doing that halfway through the year, or maybe we're in and out because of exposures and coronavirus precautions that need to happen, I think we have to understand that it takes time to build those scaffolds. And that if you're returning to hybrid now, it may take 6 or even 8 weeks to really get the children into the rhythm of being back in school. I mean, I think it's an unavoidable truth. And developmentally, I think when the schedules are inconsistent, when they're hybrid instead of 5 days a week, it can take longer rather than shorter. I know some of us are tempted to be like, it's a smaller change, it should be easier, but kids really thrive in a consistent environment. So going back and forth, it may be challenging for families and for children. Although, I mean, we're all doing the best we can, and I appreciate any in-person opportunities for kids to connect with others. Don't get me wrong, but I think that there will be some children who struggle with the inconsistency of some days at home and some days in school. So what does that mean for us? I think it means, again, that we have to give ourselves like some grace and some time and do our best to support those transitions.
When I like that you kind of gave it that time frame, not that anything's perfect within a given time frame, but at least to allow, again, that grace and that pause to know that this is going to take 6 to 8 weeks. You know, and then you have summer, and then we're going to be doing this again in the fall. So I think it's really incredibly important to continue these conversations with professionals, with our friends, with, you know, peer groups and folks that are taking care of our kids, and having those conversations when we feel like, you know, something is not going the way it should with our own personal children, and reaching out to get that support for our kiddos, whether they're the ones that you're supporting in a classroom, in the community, or in your own personal home. What would you tell your 18-year-old self if you were 18 during this pandemic, or 16? What would you tell your teenager, Kelly, Dr. Frayden self, if you were, this was your experience at this age?
Oh, I worry the most about our teens, honestly, because in so many ways, all of this seems so unfair to them. And I think at that age, there's also like this inherent like lack of patience and perspective about it. So I think what I would try to tell myself is like, this will get better. Like, things will be different. Like, all pandemics end. And so I'd try to remember that this is not going to last forever, and we will see the other side of this, because I think that provides hope. hope for the future.
As we wrap up here, what did I not ask or know enough to ask about reentry and the pandemic and our kids and trauma and anxiety and even hope and positivity and all of those? That's a big question.
What did you not ask? Let's see. I think we covered a lot. I think one thing we didn't really talk about is parent burnout, which I think is just such a problem too during this time. So I think the strain, particularly if you're dealing with a child who has extra needs, whether it's anxiety or they've been struggling with depression or really struggling to adjust to the changing school environments, that is really hard on parents. So I think acknowledging that the extra weight that those parents are carrying is important. I think a lot of parents are just struggling to balance life right now. And then you add that on top and it's this extra layer of demands when there's a problem that your child's facing that you can't fix. It's like so difficult. So I'd really encourage those parents to reach out to loved ones for support, to reach out to teachers and school administrators for support, because, you know, even though you may be at your home dealing with this, you're not alone in dealing with this. People want to help you and they're still out there, even if you're not interacting with them face to face like you normally do.
So there's the old saying about a frog in boiling water, right? So if you're in the water and it starts to boil, you don't necessarily recognize it. And then it's steaming and pouring over, boiling. And so as a parent, you know, kind of walking through this pandemic with a family, how do you start to recognize those signs of, wow? I mean, you're right. All of us are overloaded and exhausted and different levels of impact within our personal families as a result of COVID-19. But what is some advice for parents to recognize that they're in the boiling water?
When we think about burnout, I think the parents may find that they're more irritable than normal, that smaller things are upsetting them more. Maybe they're yelling more or their frustration tolerance is low. I think the other thing is that they may find that they're like not as engaged with the things that used to bring them joy, whether it's friendships or time with their children. And so I think most people have felt this way at some point in the pandemic. Like when your cup is empty, you're more likely to be irritable and to like kind of withdraw from loved ones. And so what do you do? It's a systems problem. It's not your fault. You're not alone in it. You try to do what you can to find ways to give yourself energy. If it's as simple as like getting outdoors and going for a walk or calling a friend or venting to a loved one. But I think there's one thing worth commenting on that we shouldn't do, which I read an article about it the other day. It's like revenge procrastination insomnia is what they're calling it. And it's the idea that it's not until sort of the kids go to bed that we can, as parents, like relax. And so a lot of people, myself included, have been, you know, staying up a little later to have like a little more personal time and a little more relaxation time. And then over time, you're not getting as much sleep as you should. And then actually your coping skills are worse and your anxiety is worse and you're tired on top of it. And that cycle, I find personally to be very difficult. But so I'd encourage you to like try to remember the sleep. Remember the sleep is going to make a big difference. And sometimes it is actually more rejuvenating than an extra Netflix show or whatever it is we're doing.
That extra moment. If you could have, it's hard to break that cycle. I'm absolutely guilty of that one. If you could have a billboard with one tip for parents, what would it be and why?
I think, you know, what I've tried to say to parents during this time is that like, you are enough. I think that's what it would be, right? Because parents are so worried and concerned with their families. And I think at the end of it, it's like really just by being there and loving your child, it is enough. That you don't need to be a teacher, you don't need to be a therapist, you don't need to be a doctor for your child. You just need to love them. And that at the end of the day, that love, really, it should be enough.
Beautiful. And it kind of ties back into what we were even saying earlier about giving grace and giving pause and just, you're enough. I love that. What a great way to end our conversation today. And I absolutely appreciate your time and connecting with me and providing some great nuggets of information and support for everybody during this unprecedented time, for sure.
Yes, thanks for having me. You know, and I'd love it if your listeners found this helpful, they could follow me on Instagram or Facebook at Advice I Give My Friends, or I have a newsletter on Substack that you can find the link through my website, adviceigivemyfriends.com. Of course, they could check out the book I wrote, Parenting in a Pandemic. That would be great. I'd love to stay connected and continue this important dialogue.
Thank you. And I look forward to seeing and reading more stuff that you put out there and hearing that. So thank you.
Great conversation.
Thank you for joining us today for our IEP Essentials Pro Tips podcast. To hear more pro tips and find additional IEP Essentials, including our IEP webinar, please visit www.learningessentialsedu.com.